So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to review me.
Welcome to another edition of Review Away, everybody. I am John Pollock, and he is Wei Ting. And today, Wei, we are discussing Ring of Honor Final Battle 2004.
Ring of Honor. Our fans have been clamoring, requesting in droves for a Ring of Honor review.
Yes, and we're going to get to that feedback later on in today's show. We have a boatload of feedback, including a number of comments regarding our decision to stray off the path and review Ring of Honor. Mm. So let's get into the event right away, Wei, because we have no time to waste today. Two big guests on the show, Gabe Sapolsky, who booked this show, and Samoa Joe, who was an integral part of this event.
Yes. Yes. What else am I supposed to say?
All right. Now, we should preface this by stating that these shows have aired on the Fight Network, so we had access to them here at work, and these had inserts by our good friend Bobby Cruz, who introduced each episode.
Yeah.
And that's how this show begins, with a very overmodulated Bobby Cruz introducing the first half of Final Battle 2004.
Yeah, a lot of you probably have no idea what we're talking about right here. Probably have never seen these unless you used to watch Ring of Honor on the Fight Network. John and I have both been with the TV station since its inception, and I remember these being one of the very first things that I edited as an intern when I came here into the Fight Network. And just looking at it now, holy shit, how did we ever air these? Basically, they had Bobby Cruz, who's the Ring of Honor ring announcer, stand behind, stand in front of an ROH banner that they put up backstage.
With his Fight Network t-shirt.
With a Fight Network t-shirt that we sent to him. And then the lighting, they had no lighting. ROH could not afford two lights, two 250-watt lights to use for TV. They couldn't afford that. They just basically used the whatever overhead fluorescent lamp or whatever ceiling light that they had, and they just shot Bobby Cruz with no microphone, by the way. All they had was the
microphone on the camera.
Yeah, the shotgun mic on the microphone. And they just did
a
bunch of these.
That is by far my biggest pet peeve in videos, is when people use the microphone on the camera.
Yeah.
It's not a crazy expense to get even a low-grade microphone that's going to sound a million times better than fucking shotgun mic.
Yeah.
It's just terrible. Those things are not designed for any type of audio other than, like, ambient sound that you would be if you were out in the wild and heard buffalo stampeding by you.
What's worse is, like, sometimes, I don't know, I don't think they did that in Norwich, but, like, in some interviews I've seen, they would carry a stick mic that wasn't plugged into anything, just for show. They would do interviews and point the microphone that wasn't on.
That was one of my... Oh, man, we're already shitting on this, and this was not a bad show, I thought. But the
production
whenever
value.
They do promos in Ring of Honor, and they had some great stuff here with Ricky Steamboat and Mick Foley that you could barely hear.
Yeah, yeah.
Audio definitely gets a low grade on this, but that is not, I think, why people mainly tuned into Ring of Honor.
No.
Because you had to be somewhat forgiving on the production side for the quality of matches and so forth.
And like for people that have never ever seen a Ring of Honor show, Ring of Honor basically at this time, the only way they existed was via their DVD sales. Aside from being the live event, of course, but they probably to this day still make most of their money off of DVD sales.
You know what I think was the biggest... The biggest thing that Ring of Honor had going for it was the coverage it got in the Wrestling Observer newsletter.
Sure.
That to me is what set Ring of Honor apart from any independent promotion. They had their own section in the Observer every week, mm-hmm. and they utilized that. That was their fan base.
Yes.
They were not going to be growing out and becoming, you know, a big television production. They even opted not to have television at one point because it was too costly. It was strictly through DVDs and word of mouth, and they had that coverage every single year that other promotions, whether it be 3PW or ECWA, tons of other promotions out there were never able to get. Pro Wrestling Guerrilla. I mean, there's so many out there.
Yeah.
But Ring of Honor got a ton of coverage, and it's the only reason that, I mean, We're here up in Toronto talking about Ring of Honor. When Ring of Honor's been up here, probably you can count on one hand the amount of live mm-hmm. events they've had here. Mm-hmm. And they have a following because of the internet and newsletters.
Yeah, it makes sense. And if you can really tell from the booking of this angle that the audience they are booking the show towards is definitely a very, very smart crowd.
So let's get into it. We start off, there's a promo by Bryan Danielson, Daniel Bryan to some of you. And he shoots on Loki about when they used to love wrestling. And he goes over both turning on guys, including Liger and the Rottweilers, turning on Danielson. And he threatens to take out the Rottweilers faction one by one. The Rottweilers consisting of Loki, Homicide, Ricky Reyes was in that group.
Rocky Romero.
Rocky Romero as well. And then we go to ringside with our commentary team of Jimmy Bauer, who his voice sounded eerily similar to somebody who might be a guest on this show later in the hour. And CM Punk, who was working on this show and doing commentary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it should be also noted that they did do the commentary, not live, but they would go back and record the commentary.
Yeah.
So our first matchup way is Trent Acid against Jimmy Jacobs, who some people might be familiar with. He's been an independent level talent for a number of years, and he was here working with Trent Acid. And Bauer states that Acid, we should note, this took place December the 26th of 2004, one day after Christmas. And Bauer notes that Acid didn't get any new clothes for Christmas. And Punk brings up the fact that he could be Jewish and not celebrate Christmas. The build-up for this was that both men needed a win here to stay employed in Ring of Honor. I did note that Jacobs here did have the tights prior to Zack Ryder here with the full-length leg and then no coverage on the
other
leg.
Yeah, he had the half trunks, half the pants.
The trites.
What?
Trunks and tights.
Trunks and tights.
Trunks are like the Speedo, and then tights are the full-length pants.
You know what? I was on the on a message board this past week. And
what were you doing on there?
I don't know. I don't know why. And what people have been referring to John Cena's pants.
Jorts?
Jorts.
I heard that term too. I've never heard that term before. Jorts. And that's not, yeah. I've heard that term as well. Jorts. I don't know the obsession with people to combine names. Like,
but jorts is actually is funny.
Brangelina. I hate that shit.
Yeah. Bennifer.
So lame.
Never mind. Nothing. Anyway.
We would be one. Maybe.
Jay.
What?
Jai.
Pauling.
This is very
lame.
Very homoerotic.
Early suicide dive by Jimmy Jacobs, who goes right into the barricade. And the majority of this match is Bauer just ripping apart Acid's clothing. Not literally, but just on commentary about how horrible he looks. He looks homeless, he states. And we see a Yakuza kick by Acid, but pulls Jacob up after a two count. One of my most hated spots in wrestling, when the 1-2 and the guy pulls the guy up. Because he's not done punishing him. I hate that spot.
Why do you hate that?
It's so aggravating. If you can beat the guy, then beat him. I always hate that spot.
Perhaps. I mean, I it makes sense to me. I don't know why you hate it so much. There are a lot. I mean, there's.
When would that ever happen? You're about to beat a guy in an athletic contest.
It would
storyline here is that you need to win to stay employed with the company.
Yeah. Well, let's say you, John.
Who gives a shit about punishment? Get your contract first.
Let's say you, John, were about to wrestle a midget. For instance, someone that you can easily beat. Rather than, you know, just end the match right away, you want to prove a point. You want to prove how dominant you are over the midget. So you would pretend to pin him and then lift them up for more punishment.
Well, shockingly, the tables turned and Jacobs hit the Contra Code, which you would know as the sliced bread number 2, and defeated Trent Acid. So Trent fucked himself in this match.
Then, that was a good match.
It was a fine opener. Decent 7 minutes. I'm happy with that time. They didn't kill each other in the opening match. They didn't go into near falls.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a pet peeve of mine. I've said pet peeve a lot on this earlier
couple of minutes. You are just pissed off. You hate everything.
Next up, we have Deranged and Lacey, not to be confused with Lacey Von Erich, taking on Angel Dust and Becky Bayless. Now, Deranged and Angel Dust used to be part of the group Special K, which referred to the drug and not the cereal.
They're a team of ravers.
Yeah.
That was their gimmick.
I guess they did pills and they wrestled.
They're all named after
I hear
drugs.
There's a lot of guys' gimmicks, shoot gimmicks.
Oh.
Special K, their theme music way, sounded like something right off of your iPod.
Or yours, I'd
no,
say.
No, definitely not off mine.
No.
This was just like blaring horns and shit.
Okay. Anyway, they are ravers, and they're named after drugs. You also had in the stable Cheech and Cloudy.
Who are working who worked for Ring of Honor this past weekend.
Oh, did they?
They did.
As Cheech and Cloudy?
Yes.
So they still go
still
under...
Still use those names.
They still use
they were working
skin?
Against Claudio and Chris Hero Friday night in Hamburg,
Ooh,
New York.
Wow.
The big story here is that Angel Dust is wearing tights and boots for the first time, and Punk just calls all four of these losers in this match. He has no...
Because he's straight edge.
He is, so that did play into his gimmick. The storyline here, Angel Dust and Becky aren't partying anymore, and Deranged and Lacey are still fucked up.
Okay.
Then the women get in to this match, a terrible back body drop by Bayless to Lacey. And Bauer notes, it's no diva search, I'll tell you that. An implant DDT by Lacey onto Bayless for the win. So Lacey and Deranged and their straight-edge lifestyle, or at least cleaned-up lifestyle, have improved dramatically in terms of the win-loss column. And obviously, this match shows way that there's no drug testing in Ring of Honor, because Deranged and Lacey, if only people could be here... We have a television monitor here in our studio, and a commercial featuring me just came on.
It's a commercial. No, we won't even talk about it.
I'm sure we'll find it online somewhere.
This is
people
funny.
Making fun of me. Anyway.
Another good match. I don't really get the feud. To me, it just seems like a bunch of... These guys, they look like kids. They look like a bunch of guys picked out of the backyard.
And not a gym.
And not a gym, just wrestling.
Deranged, I found, looked like DJ Pauly D from the Jersey Shore.
I don't watch that show.
I do. Then we saw Dunn and Marcos come out after Bayless was being attacked, and they do a move where one lifted a guy into an electric chair and dropped him in a seated senton onto Deranged. So we get a Dunn and Marcos feud coming out of this. Up next, Josh Daniels taking on Homicide, who is accompanied by Julius Smokes. And if you've never seen Julius Smokes, this guy's awesome.
Elevate your hate!
He's cool.
I thought he was a fantastic manager. Homicide breaks the code of honor early on without refusing to shake hands.
What is the code of honor?
Well, why don't you tell me, Wei? You were always a fan of the code of honor.
Okay, well, the code of honor is something that they established at the beginning of ROH, but I don't think they really have it anymore, do they?
No, they've kind of ditched the code.
But the code of honor is basically a set of rules that you have to follow before every match, and that includes shaking your opponent's hand before the match, and also never attacking the referee. And something else. I forget what else. I don't know.
It was in this match that I found that CM Punk was not great on commentary. I didn't think he added a whole lot. He has made gigantic strides since this period.
Has he done any commentating since?
Well, I'm more or less going on his promo ability, which you can't really translate to being great on commentary, but I just found he added very little to this show. He was kind of just there.
No, as a commentator, I didn't think he was the best. In terms of a character, I didn't think he was great on commentary, but he did add a lot of technical knowledge and explanations of moves and psychology behind moves and things like that. I think he added quite a bit, especially in this match.
So essentially in this match, we had Homicide, who is basically your street brawler, against Josh Daniels, who was the pure technician, Greco-Roman-style wrestler. And during this, they're trying to build up Danielson and Homicide for a program, as prior to this event, Danielson had challenged Homicide to a best-of-five series, which would start the following month with a tap-out match. So we see early on Homicide attacking the left arm of Daniels. Smokes, I just found, was great on the outside, but he has what some managers, they have a problem of, whereas they almost take up too much of the spotlight when they shouldn't during a match. Like, mm-hmm. His antics at ringside were just... I found myself watching him more than the match at times. Mm-hmm. And an ace crusher was hit by Homicide for a two count, and then he applied a key lock, which made perfect sense because he was working on that arm throughout the match, and he gets the tap out. I thought very, very good finish, and it builds up for this tap out match coming up next month with Danielson, and he gets the key lock over for Homicide.
That's right. The lighting and the camera work, again, with these early ROH shows, they don't have this problem anymore with the HDNet deal, but, man, in some of these early shows, it really makes these shows tough to watch sometimes.
Wasn't the worst when we finally got the tapes for the Joe Kobashi match, like the big match of the year?
That one was fine. What was wrong with that one?
Wasn't that the match where they didn't...
White balance?
White balance, that's all the cameras?
Yeah, that was Joe versus Punk 2.
Yeah, that's
the first
right.
five-star match.
Where the mat looks a different color when they cut.
Yeah. On a lot of you probably have seen Joe versus Punk 2, at least on the internet or something. But, a match that was the first North American match to receive 5 stars in Wrestling Observer in 7 years. And the cameras are different colors every shot. So anyway, growing pains. Ring of Honor has had these very short lighting grids for their low ceilings. So the cameras, anytime they were next to the ring and they would point up, they would have these blaring lights right into the shot, and just everything was overexposed and it was just shitty.
And for those of us that are, you know, for those of you out there who are thinking we're being too harsh on the production level, I'm not saying they have to look like WWE programming, okay? We realize they're an independent promotion. But some of this stuff is just elementary when mm-hmm. it comes to anything that when you are being paid to use a video camera for your living.
If you're selling this something like this, you should
There's a certain level of quality control that I expect. My standards are not going to be, watching something with giant graphics and, high production level, but... there is a certain standard that one has to achieve, I feel.
Yes.
All right, we go into our next match. It's the Embassy with Jimmy Rave representing the Embassy, who comes out with Prince Nana, a favorite of Way's, and the Outcast Killers, who come out spraying what I thought was hairspray at the crowd.
Okay. The Embassy is the stable of Prince Nana, who...
He's from Ghana and has a ton of money.
His gimmick is that he's a prince from Ghana, and has a lot of money. Basically, like the million-dollar team or whatever, like the Ted DiBiase's team. He would pay all these wrestlers to wrestle for him. And at one point, he even mentions that he had to raise taxes in Ghana so he can afford hiring people, such expensive talent as Jimmy Rave.
And the Outcast Killers.
At the raised taxes in a whole country to hire Jimmy Rave.
No wonder
Rave.
Their economy's in the shitter. Jimmy Rave was challenging John Walters for the Pure title, the man who may own the most generic pro wrestling name in the industry.
The most generic look, the most generic voice,
John Walters.
Oh, God. And Pure title match, John.
Yes. Rave is a heel, but he does obey the code of honor and shakes hands. Punk notes that Johnny Cochran is a very close friend of the Nana family. So that was interesting to note in case Nana's ever in deep water.
They didn't really take themselves too seriously in the commentary. I mean, no. Punk knew he was probably doing this for not a huge, huge audience, just for a DVD audience, and was just having fun, basically.
Should explain away the rules of a pure title match.
A pure title match, it's... Okay, here they are. There are only 3 rope breaks allowed in the match, so if you had an opponent in submission hold, they would only be able to use the ropes 3 times in order to break it. Following that, the ropes become legal, so you can't break a pin and you can't break a submission using the ropes. There are no closed fist punches to the face in a pure title match, and counts of 20 are used instead of 10 if a wrestler goes to the floor. Also, a title can change hands on a DQ or a countout. So those are the pure title rules.
Early on, we see Walters take a Shining Wizard, and he needs to reach the rope for a break. A Hurricane DDT by Walters for a 2 count. I thought that looked like an interesting spot. Then we saw a crossface by Rave as Walters meets the ropes. That was his final rope break when he reached. Then, in the spot that I just hated, we had Walters... Jimmy Rave was in the Tree of Woe, and Walters is on the floor wrenching his neck from the floor, and Rave taps out at the 19-second mark for the finish. Yeah. So Walters is standing on the floor, and he was risking being counted out while he's applying this move. So had Rave held on for one more second as the referee is yelling the count, he would have won the title. You're telling me that his pain, the pain was so excruciating.
Sure.
That he could withstand 19 seconds of it, but not 20 seconds to win the title.
Have you seen the UFC? This happens from time to time.
They are not aware. George St. Pierre, I guarantee you, was not aware of the clock when he tapped out with a second left to Matt Hughes.
But maybe Jimmy Rave was so hurt from the pain of the submission that he didn't hear the
count. There's no way you can tell me that he could not have withstood one more second to win the title.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do agree. I agree that it makes Walters look stupid for taking a risk like that, risk being counted out and losing his title just to apply the submission hold. And if you wanted them to make it a bit more realistic, I guess they could have made him tap at 18 or 17. They could have done that.
I would have been fine with that. But 19 was almost like too much for me to take. After, we should mention going into this, Prince Nana promised he would leave this show with the pure title. So afterwards, he cuts a promo, and he offers John Walters all this money. And Walters comes back into the ring, grabs a microphone, which was go-away heat for some people, just him about to talk.
Oh, my God.
And he said, "You think I'll sell out for your money, and that all this money is worth my integrity? Well, you're right." And he hugged Nana, and I thought for sure he was going to punch Nana out. No, he left with him, and I looked this up, and yes, he turned heel on this show.
Sure, yeah, that was it. The crowd, by the way, I mean, to understand something like this, like you, just hearing it right now, if you've never seen it, you'd probably think that this was the most childish, stupid gimmick, but like, the way the crowd reacted to this just tells us, you know, they know exactly what this is, and they weren't taking it seriously at all. If anything, they were cheering for Walters to sell out just because, you know, just for that type of reaction, you know, because I feel like, I mean, Prince Nana is playing the heel here, but at the same time, he knows he's playing towards a crowd that really just appreciates heels. Am I making any sense at all?
Sure way. I was just going to note that a lot of people, like John Walters was getting a pretty big push at this point in Ring of Honor, and he was a good worker. Might have been a little generic, but he was a good worker, and he still does work to this day, but he's almost fallen off the face of the earth. He does work for promotions like, I think, Big Time Wrestling, so not a lot heard of.
He doesn't
John
have
Walters.
The it factor.
I guess not. The it factor. Hardcore match coming up way, which was called a Fight Without Honor. Dan Moff and BJ Whitmer against a Carnage crew consisting of Locke and DeVito. This was only the fourth Fight Without Honor in ROH history. And they mentioned to us that Mick Foley is in the backstage area watching this, and that it could be Ricky Steamboat's final night with ROH, as he has just signed as an agent.
Ricky the Dragon Steamboat
with the WWE and
last night at ROH, as he has just signed to be an agent at WWE. Lord knows a lot of people up there need help.
A lot of guys could use the help in WWE.
Mm-hmm. Lord knows a lot of people up there need help.
Yes. And we should note that 6 months later, CM Punk signed with the WWE after this show. Moff and Locke are very, very sloppy in the ring, I found. Moff takes these big, unprotected chair shots. We see a trash can concerto. I thought the crowd early on was dead for this match.
Yeah.
Like, they just couldn't care less.
Yeah.
Punk compared this match to a car accident. I would say train wreck. DeVito hits a moonsault off of the top onto Whitmer. And that started to get the crowd into it. And Bauer notes that a lot of presents were under the Christmas tree, were not under the Christmas tree for Locke and DeVito because they cannot afford them. So we've got guys on the show who cannot afford a wardrobe, and we have guys that cannot provide for their families that are employed.
They
by
don't
Ring
get
of
paid
Honor.
A whole lot on the independent scene.
I guess not. It was a shoot. Mick Foley eventually comes out with a stocking full of thumbtacks that he pours onto the apron. DeVito hits an ace crusher on Moff for a two count. Then we see a swinging neck breaker by Locke to Moff off the apron Loke. Through a table. Loke?
Yeah.
Is it Locke or
no,
Loke?
No, it's Loke. Loke and DeVito.
I don't care. Then BJ Whitmer hits an exploder suplex onto DeVito for the win. Big pop for the finish. And to commend these four guys for putting their bodies on the line and doing it for very little money, just doing it for the fans. They thank the four by chanting Foley at the end of this match. Very depressing, I thought, after these four just murdered themselves.
Oh, these guys, they really, really killed themselves for this match.
And they do the respect angle at the end where they high-five each other and hug while Mick Foley is in the ring.
Yeah. I will say this is the perfect placement for a match like this. I mean, if I feel like if this was WCW or TNA, they would put this match on first. But they put it right after the very technical pure title match. It's just to give the fans something to see where they don't have to think too much.
With Mick Foley in the ring, it led to Ricky Steamboat coming down to the ring. After the guys leave, chants of Ric Flair sucks come out towards Steamboat and Foley. We should, to go back in time here, this was shortly after Mick Foley was backstage at a TV taping for Raw, and he went up, and of course Mick Foley and Flair had their book feud, where each guy had taken shots at each other inside of their books, and Foley apparently went up very sarcastically to Ric Flair and asked him to sign, I believe it was Flair's book for him, and he made, I believe, either some comment or just the way he approached Rick pissed him off, and it led to Flair punching Mick Foley out backstage. So that was what we had leading into this. And the storyline here in Ring of Honor at the time was that Foley had called Ricky Steamboat the softcore dragon for never being in any hardcore matches during his career, and that this was basically wrapping everything up as Steamboat was leaving to become an agent with the WWE, and Foley brought up that he had done his research and that Steamboat had strap matches with Don Morocco, cage matches with Rick Rude, and he had cage matches with Steve Austin, and that he had hardcore matches. And Foley finds it odd that Steamboat is lecturing him about pure wrestling when he's going to the WWE to work with pure wrestlers such as John Heidenreich, Gene Snitsky, Luther Reigns, and Chris Benoit.
On an ROH show from 2004.
I give up.
Chris Benoit shouldn't. Somehow he ends up on this podcast again.
I believe that if we ever go back to like 1920 and find like an old match between like Earl Caddick and Joe Stecker, Chris Benoit will somehow, maybe the first multiple German suplex spot will be in that match. There is no escaping a cameo from Benoit in these shows. Foley then says that he will make those guys good wrestlers. He'll make Benoit and Guerrero get even better and possibly make Triple H a legend.
Which the crowd boos.
Yes. And Steamboat quickly saved it saying, what you guys just did there when Triple H was mentioned, that's called having heat.
What was that? That was so weird.
That was him worried about being construed that Steamboat was part of a shot at Triple H.
But Steamboat was really awkward and, on the microphone compared to Foley. Obviously, you know,
the contract with WWE probably wasn't finalized. Foley brings up the Ric Flair incident and how he was disrespectful to a legend and he got punched in the face as a result. Foley then calls out Samoa Joe so he can also apologize for being wrong. Joe decides to clock Foley and calls him an old man, stating that they can have a match if he wants. And then Steamboat leaves to his Alan Parsons Project theme with chants of Thank You, Steamboat. Very good segment. As we mentioned, the audio left a little to be desired. And when we play our interview with Gabe Sapolsky, he'll talk about what he had planned for Mick Foley and Samoa Joe coming out of this.
It really looked like they were building up to this match, but obviously it never happened. This was a really, really long segment, but I can watch Mick Foley carry a talking segment for an hour if I had to. He's just excellent.
These guys are super beneficial to that locker room. Having guys like that, it brings in more viewers, and for the experience of just hearing these guys, I mean, it was a huge benefit for Ring of Honor at the time. It's intermission time. We go backstage. Gary Michael Capetta is with the Embassy. And then our next match, way to start off the second half of the show, is Jay Lethal against Weapon of Mask Destruction number 2. And did you know the identity of Weapon of Mask Destruction number 2?
No, who was it?
It would be El Generico.
No way.
Yep.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
They even made a joke during it where Bauer adds that he looks very generic.
Why didn't they just have him fight El Generico?
I guess, I don't know, maybe El Generico wasn't that well known at the time and was just working his Montreal dates. They make fun of his physique, stating that he was fasting before this match. We see a dragon suplex by Lethal for the win. It was pretty much a 50-50 match. And I was just wondering, why would Nana hire a nobody like Masked Destruction number 2 to take out Lethal when he has all this money at his disposal? He's raised the tax rate for El Generico.
Maybe
you want to take a guy out.
Who would he hire?
Why would you go for this guy?
He should have hired the Rock. He should have hired the most expensive guy out there.
Yeah, that would have made sense.
Okay.
We have a promo with Homicide and Julius Smokes backstage. And then we go to our tag match where Jimmy Bauer had to go solo here because it was CM Punk and Steve Corino taking on Roderick Strong and Alex Shelley. Punk had Tracy Brooks in his corner. And for those not familiar with Steve Corino post-ECW, his gimmick here is that every match is taking place in Budokan Hall circa 98, complete with his young boys that he brought to the ring, streamers, and then he did comedy ring introductions that he would do at every show where he introduced famous wrestlers from Philadelphia, including Tom Brandy, Salvatore Sincere, the fake Patriot, a recently released from jail Jim Fullington, and the list just went on and on and on. And then finally, he had his own personal ring announcer for him, who ends it by stating, "And is the fucking god of professional wrestling, Steve Corino."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this was billed as a grudge tag match, Way, which I did not interpret to mean comedy tag match, which is what this was.
This was a comedy match, yes. They were Punk and Corino, the only ones actually, working all the comedy spots. Generation Next, Shelley and Roderick Strong.
Along with Austin Aries was part of that group.
Yes, which a group that I really liked. They had all four of them were similar but different in their own way. They had the mouthpiece in Alex Shelley, the rising star in Austin Aries. Strong was the muscle, and of course Jack Evans was their high flyer. I thought they were all a very, very good stable. So here they were playing the heels against the team of CM Punk and Steve Corino.
Punk, who had one of the biggest years of anyone in ROH, is on their final show in a comedy tag match. I was not a fan of these. They worked their comedy spots in, and I laughed at a few of them. Like, they would do spots where Corino would work for a couple of minutes, he'd get tired, he'd tag out, Punk comes in, does one spot, and tags out. And Corino's just frustrated. They did another one where Punk came in, lifted Corino up onto his shoulders, and then dropped a knee onto Shelley. And Corino's reaction was essentially, what the fuck was that necessary for?
It was fun. What's wrong with putting CM Punk in a comedy match in the middle of the show? This wasn't the main event. There is no real feud here. It was a fun match.
They did lay back a bit on the comedy during one portion near the finish, but then as they moved into the finish, Corino held up Shelley, and Punk would hit the heart attack finisher, and then applies the Anaconda Vice for the tap out. So Punk and Corino get your victory here, and that is how that match ended. Way, you enjoyed it?
I liked it. I liked this match.
It was fine. I didn't hate it. It was just there.
Okay.
I think at this point, we hadn't seen really a blowaway match at this point. It was just kind of...
No.
Everything seemed to be building towards these last two matches, and that's where we go. But first, Austin Aries came out into the ring and states that Shelley has been putting Generation Next first... has not been putting Generation Next first, and says he wants the spot of Shelley as leader of Generation Next, and then they give him a beatdown. Roderick Strong stops them from fighting and delivers a backbreaker then to Shelley. So Shelley has essentially been thrown out of Generation Next, with Austin Aries presumably the new leader of the group as he heads into his world title match later tonight.
Yeah, this I really enjoyed. Aries gives Shelley an ultimatum, and then hands Shelley the mic for his response. But before Shelley can even answer, Aries just decks him. Just knocks him out. I thought it was very good.
Go to our semifinal of the night. It's Loki with Julius Smokes in his corner taking on Brian Danielson. Early on, we get chain wrestling from both and a bit of a grappling contest of each trying to get a position on each other. Key got heat after biting out of a hold. And then he would work on the left arm of Danielson. Danielson came back with a surfboard and then stretched Loki back and was teabagging him at this point. I don't know how else to describe this way. Okay. He bent Loki back so far that his face was in his balls.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very technical.
That's what he does.
I enjoyed this because Danielson was doing spots without using his left arm at all, just selling the mm-hmm. earlier work done by Loki. We see a top rope superplex by Danielson, where he did use his left arm. And then Danielson kicks Loki into the crowd, and then he puts Key onto his back, and he airplane spins him throughout the audience, which I thought had disaster written all over it if he had collided or lost his balance with this man on his shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
Homicide and Julius Smokes then attack Danielson in the audience with a chair. Jay Lethal makes the save. They fight into the lobby, and Homicide uses a key lock on Danielson, which we saw earlier in the night from Homicide. Loki is back in the ring, and he threatens the referee to call himself the winner, even though it's been thrown out, and he demands to be acknowledged as the winner. He then punches referee Sean Hansen, and in a spot that only Wei Ting could have picked this event during this week, he takes a belt and he strangles the referee, which was right out of Justin Roberts and Brian Danielson from a few weeks ago.
What's he doing? He's got a belt.
I sure hope Hansen's got good insurance.
Key's going to murder Hansen. He's going to kill him. He's strangling the life out of Hansen. The Rottweilers have crossed the line. Loki has crossed the line. First, Andrew Brian Danielson. Someone's going to help Hansen or he's going to die.
Amazing.
I couldn't believe it when I was watching this.
Well, I didn't,
you picked this event
yeah.
the best week ever.
It was just a coincidence. I didn't know this existed.
Gabe Sapolsky calls it a different term on the interview.
What does he call it?
The eye bomb comes out.
Anyway.
So we later get
moving
an update
on. Yeah.
That Danielson wins this match by disqualification. I did not like the non-finish at all. At all.
Mm-hmm. On this I guess show. They didn't want to job out Loki, and they wanted to put the heat on Danielson. Anyway, Jimmy Bauer sells this as the worst thing you can possibly do, to lay your hands on a referee.
Yes, it's reprehensible.
Well, I mean, it's just to put over the fact that, I mean, how often do we see a ref bump in a typical WWF or a TNA show?
Yes.
Three times a match?
At least.
Here, once you do it, if you do it once even,
it's a big deal.
Huge.
That brings us to our main event, Way. Samoa Joe and Austin Aries for the ROH Championship. Joe comes out to Jadakiss. The champ is here, Way.
Mm-hmm.
Then Jay Lethal is in the corner of Joe as his protege.
Yeah. Samoa Joe has been champion at this point. He's held the ROH title for 21 months.
Yes.
It's almost 2 years. And it was really this title run that
established this title as maybe that and the GHC title in NOAH as the top singles belts in the world.
Outside of WWF.
I would say these titles meant a whole lot more.
Than the WWF title?
At the time?
In a wrestler's career to win the ROH title?
No, I'm just saying of titles that people took seriously.
Yeah,
and
okay.
viewed as legitimate, as something. Something that could yeah. draw.
Yeah, so I mean, it was really this title run that put Joe on the map, and you could say ROH on the map. This almost
oh, sure.
two-year-long title run. And, well, here's his next defense against Austin Aries.
It's a very, very hard-hitting match. Kicks from both guys. Aries teases a brain buster but can't lift Joe early on in the match. We get the Olay kick on the floor with Aries sitting on a chair. Joe teases a power bomb, but Aries comes back with a Hurricane Rana for a near fall. And then Joe returns with an island driver for a two count, which another established move that Joe had at the time. Aries stops the muscle buster. And going into this match, I don't think many people gave Aries much of a chance. Like, just psychologically, they were not preparing themselves to see anything out of the norm here. Mm-hmm. But after Aries hit a 450 splash for a near fall, it was like this crowd just all of a sudden got behind Aries mm-hmm. and suddenly believed that this guy could win this match. And the final couple of minutes, this crowd was electric for the rest of this.
Mm-hmm.
Austin Aries counters a muscle buster and turns it into a crucifix to then come back and hit two big running clotheslines, a brain buster, and then finishes off with a 450 for the win and a gigantic pop as Austin Aries becomes the fourth Ring of Honor champion in the promotion's history at this point.
Yes, and I like the detail where once Aries hit that brainbuster and it looked like he was about to go up for the 450 for the win, the announcers just completely remained silent.
Yeah, it was very effective.
Let the whole little bit breathe, and you can almost kind of tell that the people putting the show together knew that the audience doesn't want commentary a lot of times. They just let the moment speak for itself.
And after the match, Joe cut a promo handing the title over to Aries, telling him to be a respectful champion and defend the title. And all this did was put more heat on the title, I thought. The fans are chanting ROH, and you really did a great job, I thought, with Austin Aries. And this whole show seemed to be built around that main event and the big title change. And they did. I thought it was done very, very effectively. So at this point, we're going to go to our interviews. First up, we're going to hear from Samoa Joe discussing the 21-month title reign and the effect it had on his career.
Now, were you surprised when they put the title on you and kept it on you for 21 months? Because, I mean, in the world of pro wrestling today, man, if a guy gets to keep a title belt for 2 months, it's something. Like, that's a major reign in this day and age.
It was really funny because I was just starting to talk more with Gabe, and we were still having, you know, sparing contact back and forth, you know, just kind of just shoot messages back and forth. And he called me up one day and says, "Hey, listen, I'd like to put the title on you." And I said, "Well, okay, you know, that's cool. You know, wow, you know, I was impressed. I was like, well, gee, that's kind of sudden." And so he put the belt on me, and then after he had the belt on me, he's like, "Oh, you know what?" He's like, "I think we can run with this for like a year." And I looked at him, and I was like, and I'm totally looking at him, you're ridiculous. You know, you're not going to run with this for a year. Nobody runs for year-long title reigns. So, sure enough, the defense kept coming. We kept going, and a year had gone by. And Gabe looked at me and goes, "We can do 2 years. We can totally get 2 years out of this, and the payoff's going to be great." So then we get into our second year, you know, and it just was, it just kind of built from there. And you know, next thing you know, we're 2 years in, and Austin Aries is up to bat, and it paid off in the end.
Yeah, I think of all the pro wrestling titles in North America, it's the one that has the strongest feeling for as a real title because of what you guys did.
Well, I mean, I think that's just, you know, it saddens me to see titles kind of thrown around or used as props instead of what they are, which is a championship. I mean, it's a sign that you're the best, you know, at what you do, and I think you have to treat it that way. You know, if you want your world champion to be seen as the best in the world, then you got to treat it that way. Mm-hmm. And Ring of Honor does a fantastic job of doing that. I mean, when you go to a Ring of Honor show, you know that every Ring of Honor wrestler wants the ROH World Championship. You know, that there's that feeling, and you know the fans respond to that. The fans have that feeling. You know, they look upon the belt with great respect because it's been treated with great respect. And I think you know, a lot of promotions around the world could really learn from that. And realize that, you know, all the great booking in the world will never, ever, you know, outdraw a good championship. You know, when people want to see somebody with a belt, that's what they want to see. You know, you can write a story up and down. You can kill somebody's grandmother. You can stab their girlfriend. That doesn't matter. You know, at the end of the day, it's about who's the champion. And yeah. I think a lot of pro wrestling companies kind of outthink themselves in that aspect, and just need to realize, you know, hey, it's about the belt.
That was Samoa Joe chatting with Dan the Mouth Lavransky. That was back in 2007 that he spoke to us about that ROH title reign. And then earlier this week, I had a chance to talk with the current vice president of Dragon Gate USA. He is also the booker with Evolve Wrestling, and they have shows coming up in July. But we went back to chat with Gabe about this Final Battle 2004 event that he booked and his thoughts on the show.
We're chatting here with the creative force behind Dragon Gate USA and Evolve. He's joining us today to chat about a number of topics, including shows coming up in July, and as well, we wanted to pick his brain about the Final Battle 2004 event. He is Gabe Sapolsky. And Gabe, thanks for chatting with us today.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Well, first of all, Gabe, let's chat about going all the way back here to December of 2004. And my first question was, when you guys launched Ring of Honor, was a year-end show kind of always in mind as the big show to be building towards, or was it something that you guys kind of grew into, especially after the huge success with the inclusion of the All Japan talent in 2003?
That's actually a really good question. Yeah, it was something we grew into. It definitely wasn't something that was planned from day one from Final Battle. In fact, I remember sitting down with Doug and Doug Gentry and, you know, just trying to come up with a name and final battle came out of my mouth, and he liked it, and we went with it. And, you know, Rob Feinstein, the guy who was the original owner of ROH, he liked it too. And I guess it sounded kind of Japanese. And basically, you know, we were just looking for a name of a show for the year-end show in 2002. At the time, there was a lot of competition in Philly. It was a pretty ugly wrestling war in Philly at the time with all the independent groups. And you needed kind of a show name that kind of made a statement just to try to make the show seem more important than it was. You know, try to get a little bit of a competitive advantage, so that whole final battle name came about. And that's, you know, and then we just grew into it. And then 2003, the All Japan thing fell in our laps, and that was something that was set up by Rob and Doug. And so then that kind of made the show more important, and that led us to 2004, which, you know, at that point they were both gone.
Now, obviously, the major story on the 2004 show was the big finish to Samoa Joe's title reign after 21 months, and it was really his run with that title that took the ROH title and made it perhaps even the top championship in the world at that time. In terms of your booking, I mean, how far back were you planning for this title change, and when did kind of Austin Aries click to you as the guy to succeed Joe? Because it was obviously going to be a very difficult task, you know, taking that top spot there.
Yeah, well, it was planned for a while for Joe to drop the belt around that time. I think we were actually going to hold off to the anniversary show, but then Steve Corino had canceled a Chicago date in October, and that kind of pushed the whole Punk series up a couple shows, because we had to hotshot the match in Chicago, because, you know, we couldn't, when with Steve Corino not being able to attend after we advertised him, we couldn't just throw anything out there. We had to give him a top match in Chicago that was a top market for us. So that kind of pushed the whole Punk program up. So Joe wasn't going to lose the belt until after the Punk program. And then the final match ended up being with Punk on December 4th. So that left us this final battle as the right time to do the title change. And Aries, you know what, I remember struggling with you know, we had to do a title change because Joe's run, it was over. You know, he had done everything he could as champion. It was time for him to make a new face, and any longer would have just been stretching it out way too long. And I remember just struggling for a while, trying to figure out who the belt to go to. And actually, the first FIP weekend was, you know, Aries was a name, obviously, in my mind. And then the first FIP show was in September, and we actually got hurricaned in. Aries and I spent about 24 hours at the airport together, because there's a hurricane and our flights couldn't take off after that. And I got to know him. And, you know, an important thing when you put the belt on somebody and you put them in that position on top angle is being able to trust them. And, you know, seeing that they're a good person, seeing that they're someone that can handle that spot and that you can put the company on their shoulders, those are all things you have to consider. You're not just looking for the best possible wrestler. You're looking for someone you can trust. And Aries and I hung out for that day, and we hung out for the whole weekend. But, you know, we spent an extra day at the airport where we were just sitting there for 24 hours basically waiting for our flight. And you know, we formed a friendship then. And you know, I saw that he was a guy that we could put the belt on, and he was able to handle it. And that's where that selection all came from. So a lot of it can go back to that hurricane.
So a near natural disaster somewhat caused this title change.
I mean, it was good. The title change was going to happen, but it solidified the fact that it was going to go to Aries.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, going back to the match, there was just such a great dynamic when you look at the beginning of the match, where I think a lot of people looked at Aries and maybe not really behind him as, you know, having a strong chance of winning this. And I think it was right after a 450 splash where the last 5 to 8 minutes of this match, that crowd was just unglued leading up to the finish. And I know it's going back a few years, but do you recall the live crowd there in Philadelphia? Because it was one of the hotter Ring of Honor main events that I recall seeing.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it was one of the greatest moments ever. I mean, it was absolutely tremendous, and they did a great job. You know, the only thing that I said was make sure it was a solid finish, which obviously meant the 450, and Aries and Joe both did a great job putting together that finishing sequence. And Joe, you know, put over Aries like $1 million and put him over strong, and it was a fantastic moment. You know, you're really nervous going into something like that, because the Joe title reign was something really special, and in order to really solidify it in history, it needs to end on a really strong note. You know, if it ends with a whimper, it kind of puts a taint on the whole thing. So, you know, it needs that strong finish, and those guys produced.
What were some of the keys for you in terms of booking Samoa Joe after that long title reign and kind of keeping him in the mix but also removing him out of the title picture?
I think that we had Mick Foley to work into right after that.
Right.
So, you know, we were able to go right into that. So it doesn't really, you know, you go from a title reign into working a program with Mick Foley, which I took a gamble he was going to wrestle, you know. I knew there was a chance he was going to wrestle and there was a chance he wasn't going to wrestle. Sometimes you take a gamble and you get a match out of it and sometimes you lose. And, you know, unfortunately we didn't get Foley to wrestle Joe. So, you know, that didn't go down the way, you know. But, you know, you still had Mick Foley to segue into, and, you know, then you had the whole Rottweiler thing and that kind of stuff. So, you know, the whole key is just having strong programs to follow up with.
Aside from just the name value of having a guy like a Mick Foley and Ricky Steamboat, we also saw doing his farewell on this show. What kind of an impact did those guys specifically have on the locker room during their run in 2004? Because you have these great minds working with young talent, and it just seemed like a win-win for everybody.
I mean, it was really important to have them there. I think everyone got better while they were there. You definitely need those guys to really know the tricks of the trade down for years and years and years, and most importantly, are unselfish and sharing that knowledge. And that describes both Ricky Steamboat and Mick Foley.
Now, as we move down to the Bryan Danielson and Low-Key match that was also a part of the final battle event, of all weeks that we picked this one to review this week, the finish of this, we get the non-finish, but afterwards we see Low-Key choke out the referee with a belt, which I found very interesting considering the current climate right now over the past couple of weeks in the WWE.
I guess that is ironic. I actually remember that being a really disappointing match. You know, I think Low-Key was in his moody days, and he was kind of moody going into it, and I just remember it being a disappointing match. In fact, I remember most of the undercard on that show being pretty disappointing. I don't remember it well, but I remember that it was really pretty much like a one-match show with that Aries and Joe match. I could be wrong. I'd have to look at the lineup again. You know, I didn't before this interview, but yeah, and I just don't think that match delivered the way that it could have. But I think that was also part of it, too, was making sure that Joe and Aries did have that strong finish. Part of it was not doing too much on the undercard. You know, when you have a super strong and important finish like that, you know, you don't want, you know, those guys, you want those guys going out and giving the fans their money's worth, of course. That's important. And, but, like, you know, they can't go out there and have the greatest match in wrestling history and then leave the crowd burned out for Joe and Aries.
What was the necessity for the non-finish in that match? Did that have to do with Low-Key, who was obviously he had Japan dates at that time? Was that part of the decision to have the non-finish?
No, I mean, I think part of it was I don't remember exactly, but I think part of it was just that you want to have a super strong finish to the show with Aries and Joe. So I think part of the non-finish was kind of to give some contrast there, you know, like. You don't really want to have a super strong finish in that match, especially, you know, Bryan and Low-Key was a huge match. That was kind of it wasn't meant to be a match that, like, ended the feud between those two or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So the idea was to do a non-finish to build to another match between the two and at the same time have contrast to that strong finish that you're going to have to end the show.
Now, we'll wrap up in just a few minutes, but a big emphasis on this show was on submissions at this point in your product, being well ahead of the curve at the time. We all saw the big mixed martial arts explosion that began in 2005, but watching this show, it's very easily transferable to 2010. Did you somewhat sense the climate change at the time and working into submissions a lot more on this show, which I found?
Yeah, I mean, I was always a big fan of submissions, and then, of course, the roster that we had were all big fans of submissions. You know, the Bryan Danielson and Low-Key and Samoa Joe and everybody was into that kind of wrestling, and all those guys were ahead of the curve. You know, most of our roster at the time was really ahead of the curve wrestling-wise, and that's what they enjoyed doing. You know, the guys had a lot of freedom back then. So, you know, if they wanted to incorporate a lot of submissions, you know, that they did, and that's what they were into. So you can pretty much say that everyone on the roster was ahead of the curve at that time.
2004 was also the first year that you received the Booker of the Year award with the Wrestling Observer newsletter. When you received accolades like that, did it ever add certain pressure on yourself, and especially for the audience you were booking for, are, you know, some of the smartest fans out there? Did that ever somewhat, you know, with certain pressure be added upon you when booking?
No, not really. I didn't really feel any extra I mean, you know, I mean, it's a newsletter award. You know, you take it for what it is, and you know, it's a nice compliment, and it's definitely, you know, something that I greatly appreciate. But you know, it's not like, you know, winning an Emmy or something, like, you know, you're not winning the Nobel Prize here or anything, you know. So, you know, it is what it is. It's a nice compliment, and to me, you know, a nice thank you for you know, the people who are watching the product.
How ironic.
It was not ironic, but it was interesting. So that, thanks very much to Gabe Sapolsky and Samoa Joe for chatting with us about Final Battle 2004, and Wei, we got a ton of feedback to get to. So let's start off with that. Oh, I didn't give you yours, did I?
No.
So we'll start off with Leroy Nicky Barnes, who starts it off. Isn't it ironic how the invasion angle happened during the same time Wei Ting and John have been reviewing the WCW ECW invasion? Lol. Lul.
Laughing on. Wait, laughing out loud. Yeah. Anyway, Jay Hunter says, "Feel so bad for you guys reviewing this pay-per-view. I didn't get past the opening matchup."
This was the Great American Bash, everybody.
"After seeing the opening vid with Tank Abbott, Flair vs. Flair, and Hogan Kidman, then the hokey army gimmick of Hugh Morris and company, I was done. You guys should review a great pay-per-view or those wrestling-related TV shows like South Park or It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia to give you an easy week." And you know what? Jade sent us links to those shows, so we could very well be doing one of those soon.
Patrick McHugh writes, "So the Maryland Athletic Commission was worried about a small cut during the boot camp match, but had no problem with an inferno match where someone was going to get set on fire. A great point that shreds the credibility of the Maryland Athletic Commission on the Great American Bash."
Mm-hmm. Biggest fan of Review Away says, "Hey guys, love the show, love the review of the Bash 2000. I tweaked my name a bit so it may help end confusion if people are trying to find your show instead of my page. I guess you guys recorded the last podcast before Bryan Danielson was released by the WWE. I would love to hear your thoughts on his firing on the next podcast, as I am assuming, and I believe his firing, to be a shoot. Peace out, Dan S., a.k.a. Review Away's biggest fan." By the Wei,
spelled like your name.
"The old confused father of Hugh Morris was originally supposed to be a serious angle, with Hugh having to take care of his elderly father, but it was scrapped quickly. They brought the old guy back when Russo started the Misfits in Action angle as a comedic character. However, it was no laughing matter."
Can you imagine if they had done that as a serious angle? Holy shit.
That would be... Yeah.
Peter!
Well, what were your thoughts on the Bryan Danielson
thing? Yeah, we should chat about that quickly. I mean, I thought it was a shoot right from the start, and I think we pretty much got that answer this week. And will he be back? I would be shocked if he's not back within 3 months.
Yeah, much the same. I personally thought it was a work. From the beginning, because
I just didn't understand why should it, if he just showed up, I mean, it adds nothing to the angle.
No,
to be fired.
No,
I mean, seriously, and come back
at this point, knowing everything that we do know, I do believe it. But at the time, it seemed like they were gunning for the internet demographic so much with this Bryan Danielson character, with the whole Michael Cole thing starting from NXT, that it wouldn't be above them to work a firing. But as we know, he's gone, and maybe not the driver of that limo.
Oh yes, the drama ensues on Raw.
You are just pissed off today.
No, I'm not pissed off at all. I wasn't a big fan of Raw on Monday night. I didn't like their follow-up at all. A lot of people thought, oh, it could have been a lot worse. I thought it was worse. Wasn't a big fan of it at all. I hated that closing angle with the stupid limo. Peter writes, "Landing on the beach refers to the Allied forces taking the shores of Normandy in Nazi-controlled France back in World War II, meaning that you're ready for the ultimate showdown. I know John said he didn't care, but still." Well, thank you, Peter.
Andy Simpson writes, "Vanilla Ice was sued by Queen for using the Under Pressure bass riff. He didn't ask permission to use it, nor did he go to their publishing company and pay them the money required to use the riff. Good on Queen for getting the money that they deserve for their work."
Oh, Vanilla Ice. That could have killed his career. Jordan Ducharme writes, "God damn it, Vince Russo sucks. I can't believe that ridiculous pay-per-view. I actually saw New Blood Rising live, which features a Judy Bagwell on a forklift match and some more shit I can't remember, thankfully. Anyways, I just went through a very long ROH phase. I ordered like 50-plus ROH DVDs online, and Final Battle 04 is one of them. 2005 really launched ROH, and 2006 is probably the best year the company has seen, and I think all that started with this awesome show.
Then we have Jack Pisco writing that the WCW Great American Bash 2000 pay-per-view was terrible in every way except for a few liners here and there from Madden, Schiavone, and Hudson. The work rate was not there. The main event was overbooked. The bimbo backstage interviews were bungled. The unnecessary Hogan and Flair matches just plain sucked. And Sting in flames and a lame stunt jump. My God, I don't envy the poor bastard who paid for this. Which was you.
Yes. I don't envy him either. Ryan Gilbert, listen to the review of the Great American Bash. Probably one of the best reviews you guys have done so far. I especially like the discussion John and Way had on the comparison of the NXT angle and the 2001 invasion. Looking forward to hearing on your thoughts on Final Battle 2004, since as much as I like to hear comments and thoughts on bad shows, getting to hear opinions on the art of pro wrestling like the review of When Worlds Collide is great stuff to listen to. As for a suggestion for a review, what about some episodes from the Canadian-produced pro wrestling sitcom Learning the Ropes, starring Lyle Alzado, Stephanie from Degrassi Junior High, and guest stars like Ric Flair, the Road Warriors, Dick Murdoch, and many other NWA wrestlers from the late 80s.
I totally review one of these. I saw somebody posted a trailer for that on the Facebook group once, and I mentioned that my marketing teacher from Ryerson was the producer of this show.
So we could get a guest on.
Mr. Falzon, maybe.
You could interview him. That should be your first interview.
Oh. Muhammad Al-Zubadi. Oh my God, that rant by Way about how the Great American Bash made him hate his life, like how his couch was too small or he had no place to rest his thighs. Epic.
It was epic. It was all a very right. good rant you had last
Thanks.
Week.
Thanks. Right? Thanks for taking pleasure all in right. my misery.
I'm not going to read this whole thing from Evan Harden, who gave us a review of Great American Bash 2000, but quickly. I apologize for posting this twice on the discussion board, but I promise that this time I will talk about the Great American Bash and the Bash only. Great review, guys, on the Great American Bash 2000. You guys never make me stop laughing, because at every review, there's always the one comment that will make the whole review look good. I don't remember this pay-per-view, but I do remember a majority of WCW in 2000, and boy, did I wish I hadn't. I would like to recite a couple quotes from Vince Russo's book. Surprisingly, I haven't thrown it in the fire pit yet. Rope Opera, How WCW Killed Vince Russo. Or in other words, How Vince Russo Killed WCW. Quote, I get tickled, absolutely tickled, when I hear the critics say that Vince Russo killed WCW. Man, that's a lot of hard work and dedication for just one man in just under a 3-month span, because that's exactly how long I had any kind of control in WCW. I mean, to take a 13-year-old company and utterly destroy it in a matter of 3 months, I'm Cloverfield. That alien took Manhattan down in a day, so I guess anything's possible. It must have been the Tank Abbott thing. It couldn't have been that David Arquette thing, could it? No, it was definitely the Tank thing. Damn Tank Abbott. Damn him. Vince Russo's pathetic defense. Well, we're not going to talk about Vince Russo's book, because I read that, and spoiler alert, it's my worst book of 2010.
Yeah. Next we get to feedback about my choice for reviewing this Ring of Honor.
Yes, I just picked some of the feedback from people in terms of if they want to hear more reviews of Ring of Honor. And first of all, I want to say I enjoyed reviewing this show quite a lot. I thought it was a good break from our regular stuff, and I really enjoyed watching it. But I understand a lot of people may not have access to Ring of Honor, don't have the history with it that others do. So let's
see. Yeah, and I just even finishing the review now, I didn't find it very fun to listen to myself talk about. It's more fun to complain about something.
Well, do you want to read some of these?
Yeah.
Okay. Jay Hunter writes, it's good to mix it up now and then and restore your faith in wrestling, but I wouldn't like to hear regular reviews of ROH. They're a straight wrestling company, so there's not much stuff to laugh at, unlike the awful WCW shows with many silly gimmicks and booking, etc., which make for great reviews. I do like it when you guys review movies and TV specials. The baser, the better.
Okay. Graeme McPhail. I think on the whole, people...
What a great name.
Graeme, yeah.
McPhail.
I think on the whole, what people love about Review Away is the childhood nostalgia of old WWF and WCW shows. Nothing against ROH, but it isn't going to have the nostalgia aspect, the politically incorrect characters, or the hammy commentary that we love from the old shows.
Jeremy Levin, I like ROH, but I think the problem is that people would want to watch a show themselves, one they can easily access and watch. I like going back and watching the shows you review because they give me a funnier perspective. I'm all against piracy, but there are no available online links to watch the full show. I think sometimes it helps your case.
Good point. Richard Holm, I agree with Graham. Personally, my favorite views are from WWF or WCW, specifically era 1990 to 2002. The nostalgic factor is key for me. I like to download the pay-per-view that you're about to review, watch it myself, and then listen to your show and relate to the topic you are discussing, whilst also reliving the characters and wrestling storylines from my yesteryear. See more. Oh,
that's from Facebook.
Anyway. But with the TNA and ROH reviews, there is no nostalgia or significance for me because I didn't watch them in my youth. Therefore, I don't relate to those particular reviews.
From Muhammad, I'm really not a fan of ROH, so I wouldn't have to say no. I don't want to hear any ROH reviews. As a 90s nostalgic, I love the old WWF and WCW reviews. If you can focus on those two promotions, especially during the 90s and WWF up until 2004, I would really appreciate it.
Ben Brisebois, I thought your review of When Worlds Collide from a while ago was pretty interesting. I don't remember there being anything funny on it. Not saying there wasn't anything funny, I just don't remember because it was a while ago. It's good to do that once in a while if you just want to watch a good, pure wrestling show instead of torturing yourselves. I found Review Away in the first place when I was looking through random old WWF and WCW shit for nostalgia's sake. I don't blame you if you want to be more serious once in a while. I'm assuming that none of us became wrestling fans for the sole purpose of making fun of stupid shit.
And we'll finish off with Patrick McHugh. I'm going to throw it out there that a lot of people that listen to the show listen to hear funny reviews of shitty wrestling angles and matches that when you actually think about them, make no sense at all. As good as some of the matches of Final Battle were, and just about everything ROH did at the time was pretty amazing, lots more people would be interested in hearing about how shit WCW was. So thank you, everyone.
Appreciate the
I'm glad that you just want to hear us tear shit apart and be negative. That's fine, though.
What do you give this show, John?
The Ring of Honor show, I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10, to be honest. I wasn't blown away by this show. And the Loki Danielson match, really, I enjoyed the early part of it, but the finish really hurt, in my opinion, because this wasn't just a transition show. This was Final Battle, and I expected something, a finish in the match. And whether it was Loki, as Sapolsky alluded to, being in one of his moods, not really contributing a lot to the match, I don't know. But the main event really carries this show. I thought it was a fantastic finish. And some good stuff on this show. Nothing embarrassing, nothing horrible. But I've seen better from Ring of Honor.
Yeah. To me, what stood out most about this show to me was just what ROH is. Especially when going from Great American Bash 2000 to this. It just seemed so far ahead from what we were watching last week. I'm going to give it an 8. Because basically, ROH is a product with a real challenge. They have to book for an audience that knows exactly what pro wrestling is. Exactly, they have to book for an audience that a lot of times are able to book better than they are. Like, they have the hardest audience to please a lot of times.
Sure.
So, I don't know. I think it's a very interesting product, and I urge you to check it out. You won't laugh at it, but you will enjoy it.
All right, before we pick our event for next week, we encourage all of you to go join the Review Away Facebook group at reviewaway.com, reviewaway.com. We're approaching that 850 figure way for members, and I would like to hit 1,000. I think that's our new goal, is 1,000.
Okay.
So let's get the push on.
What then? What happens when we hit 1,000?
That'll be our peak.
No, but what are we going to do? We should do something. Like, if we can get to 1,000 members, we will unleash something into the world.
Maybe that can be a question we throw out for everybody this week to post on the wall, is what should we do to celebrate 1,000 members?
Yeah.
And maybe it'll encourage people to get us to 1,000 closer.
Okay.
So I'm going to go back to a WWF show for next week, Way, because coming off of last week's Human Torch match, I still find that to be one of the most entertaining matches we have reviewed, and I think a lot of people enjoyed matches where people are lit on fire. So we are going to go with a match that maybe isn't always immediately what you think of with this event, but was part of it. And that was Steve Austin against Kane, where Kane promised to light himself on fire if he did not win the match from the King of the Ring 1998, which also featured a little-known Hell in a Cell match.
Hmm.
So I thought we would review that next week, Wayne.
Awesome.
It gets back into people that I think every single person listening has at least seen one match on that card.
Yes.
So Mankind. We can go see what the fuck else was on this King of the Ring event.
Yeah, that's so cool.
That is my choice for next week, Way. And how do you want to end up off things?
Well, I have actually one more piece of email from a listener. His name is Andrew Patterson, and he happens to be from the Netherlands.
Oh, wow.
I'm a longtime fan of The Law, and Reveal Way has also grown near and dear to me. I've been a wrestler for a little over 8 years now, and was trained by Chris Hero and Brian Danielson, of all people.
Wow.
Right now, I mostly work in the Netherlands, Belgium, and Germany. Well, anyway, I wanted to share with you a song that I wrote and performed along with my old band, Headshot. We were actually pretty good and won a lot of competitions that got us free recording time, so we had some quality material. One of the songs recorded was a song about the Iron Sheik called Camel Clutch. It came into existence when we were jamming one day and got kind of an Arabian vibe going. And it hit me that I could write a badass Iron Sheik tribute to this. Even though I was the only wrestling fan in the band, we performed it well enough that crowds at our gigs were actually singing along to a song about Iron Sheik. I live in the Netherlands, so this was amazing and hilarious to me, and still is. Anyway, here's a link to the song. And it's quite lengthy, but has about as many layers as the Iron Sheik himself. Enjoy, Andrew Patterson. So check out this song, listen to the lyrics, and if you dig it, please add Andrew Patterson on Facebook and talk to him about being trained by Brian Danielson, Chris Hero, and what it's like to wrestle in the Netherlands and Europe.
Cool. We'll go out to Camel Clutch from Andrew Patterson, and the next week we're reviewing the 1998 King of the Ring.
We'll be right back. can't trust back. I see a chip, I'm gonna break your neck. You won't all be destroyed when I motherfucking touch y'all. Gun to touch y'all. I hit a punch on that disrespect.